Hello and welcome to another episode of Podcast DX, the show that brings you interviews with people just like you, whose lives were forever changed by a medical diagnosis. I'm Lita.
I'm Ron.
And I'm Jean Marie.
Collectively, we're the hosts of Podcast DX. Our guest today is Sophia Anna. Now, Sophia, is your middle name Anna or your last name Anna?
My last name.
Okay, Sophia Anna. Sophia is the social media coordinator for the Australian Sickle Cell Advocacy South Australian page. She also has her own YouTube channel, The Sick Sexy. That caught my attention. Through which she helps spread awareness regarding what it's like to live with an invisible illness. Sophia, as you could probably tell, is joining us from Australia to talk about sickle cell anemia and avascular necrosis.
Avascular
necrosis? Okay. Hi, Sophia.
Hi, Sophia.
Hi, guys.
Thanks for joining us, Sophia. Can you start out by first telling our listeners what exactly is sickle cell disease?
Absolutely. So according to the U.S. National Library of Medicine, sickle cell disease is an inherited red blood cell disorder, which is characterized by sickle or crescent-shaped red blood cells that get stuck within the blood vessels and cause blocked blood flow, and that affects oxygen and hemoglobin from traveling to different parts of the body. So there are different variations of the disease, and the specific technical term for my variation is called sickle beta thalassemia. Now, sickle beta cell beta thalassemia affects red blood cells, both in the production of abnormal hemoglobin as well as a decreased synthesis of beta globin chains. So individuals with sickle beta thalassemia have one abnormal beta chain and a defective beta globin gene. The reason I have a variation of the disease is because my mum has the thalassemia trait. She's from Greek origin. And my dad has the sickle cell trait, being of Guyanese South American origin. But for the sake of keeping things simple, I refer to my condition as sickle cell anemia.
Okay.
Sophia, when were you first diagnosed with sickle cell disease?
So I was diagnosed with sickle cell disease at birth, but I didn't suffer my first crisis until I was 6 months old. This was due to the fact that fetal hemoglobin can inhibit sickle cell hemoglobin, which means that basically being a baby protects you for a little while from having a crisis.
Oh, well, that's nice.
Yeah, that is nice. That like built-in protection. I mean, and Sophia, what symptoms are associated with your particular type of sickle cell anemia?
So some of the symptoms of sickle cell disease which I experienced growing up included things like severe pain crises that occurred in any part of the body. Predominantly for me, they were in my legs and my back, so obviously caused by blocked blood flow, a lot of anemia and fatigue, and occasional bone pain.
Oh, you poor thing.
Yeah, that's terrible.
I understand you also have avascular necrosis. According to John Hopkins Medicine, avascular necrosis is a disease that results from the temporary or permanent loss of blood supply to the bone. When blood supply is cut off, the bone tissue dies and the bone collapses. If avascular necrosis happens near a joint, the joint surface may collapse. This condition may also happen in any bone. It most commonly happens in the end of a long bone. It may affect one bone, several bones at one time, or different bones at different times. Can you please explain to our listeners how this has affected you particularly?
Absolutely. So we'll start with my diagnosis. So I was 13 years old when I was diagnosed with avascular necrosis. I'm now 26. When I was 13, I remember very vividly lying in bed one night and I was trying to do the splits as any 13-year-old would in bed. And I remember not being able to extend my left leg any further than a certain point, and I thought that was quite strange. But obviously when you have something like sickle cell, it's almost easy to become complacent when it comes to pain because it's such a normal part of your daily life. That I kind of lived with that pain without telling anyone about it. And then my parents noticed that I started developing a limp. And that's when we decided to go and see an orthopedic doctor. So I had an x-ray taken which showed excessive necrosis to my left femoral bone. The joint bone had completely collapsed. So I remember sitting in a very white clinical room and an orthopaedic doctor breaking the hard news to Mum and I that this is what I had. I was told that I essentially had a dead hip bone and that I would never walk again and would have to live in a wheelchair for the rest of my life. Definitely a tough pill to swallow at 13.
13 years old. Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I did the wheelchair gambit for about 6 months through my first 6 months of high school before I forced myself to try and stand on a pair of wooden crutches. It was definitely a heartbreaking experience for a young girl trying to make an impression in a world where disability was still such a stigma. And this was 14 years ago, so you have to remember that we as a society were not so embracing of disability at that point. But after that point, I kind of mind over matter forced myself to walk, and it's now been... Well, I don't know how it's been over a decade. I don't use any aid to walk with. I do have a limp. You can't really notice unless I've been doing too much strenuously, but it's definitely there. So obviously the pain is still there. It's chronic pain. It's there 24 hours a day, but I have successfully managed to walk without the aid. And unlike what the doctors diagnosed and said I would never walk again, I most certainly am walking.
Well, that's good news.
Good for you. That's fantastic.
So a hip replacement is not an option for you?
So I was offered a total hip replacement at the age of 17, but I was told that because the material that they use, obviously for a total hip replacement, it's not everlasting. So it does have a shelf life of 10 to 15 years. So I would eventually have to have a second hip replacement in my 30s, and obviously the risk increases with every hip operation you have.
Sure.
And especially if you have sickle cell disease, your risk is even higher. So I made the personal choice that I would wait till I couldn't handle the pain anymore. So I'm potentially looking at getting a hip replacement done in my 30s at this stage, but it's been a personal choice for me to try and keep my joint operating as long as I possibly can.
Okay. Well, that's good.
It's
good that you're thinking that far ahead and making those decisions based on what medicine has available right now.
And that's very tough at 17 to make that decision. Sophia, what other kinds of treatments are there for the necrosis?
Yeah, absolutely. So according to the Johns Hopkins, there are medicines that you can take to control the pain. So here in Australia, we have non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medicines such as Nurofen and Panadol, or you have prescription medications that are analgesics. They can be narcotic-based, so things like Tramadol, Endone. You also have, obviously, assistive devices such as crutches and wheelchairs that helps to reduce the weight on the bone. You have cord decompression. This is a surgical procedure that involves removing the inner layer of the bone to reduce pressure, increase blood flow, and slow or stop the bone destruction. You've got osteotomy. This procedure reshapes the bone and reduces stress on the affected area. You've got things like bone grafts. That's where a healthy bone is transplanted from another part of the body into the affected area. And then you've got the joint replacement, which is a full total hip replacement of the damaged joint with an artificial joint. And so this is pretty much like the last resort if other treatment options have failed to relieve the pain and disability. Other treatments may include electrical stimulation and combination therapies like physiotherapy to promote bone growth.
Okay. They don't do stem cell therapy for that, do they?
So in my case, because the femoral bone had completely collapsed by the time I was diagnosed, it was too late for cord decompression, bone grafts, and all of the other methods that were mentioned.
Okay.
So assistive aids such as crutches and a wheelchair were offered to me, and you know, based on the discussion with my hematologist, it was recommended that I try and use the joint as much as possible, because obviously if you sit in a wheelchair for any long period of time, the joint, you know, the joint's already dead and it's already collapsed, but then there's obviously surrounding tissue and joints that can be affected. So I manage the pain non-invasively and I have regular consultations with my hematologist. But because the bone has arthritis, I'm not sure if it's capable of any more deterioration at this point. It is in its final stage and it has kind of grown back in its own way, but it is deformed.
Okay. Thank you.
Sophia, we have heard that a sickle cell crisis is the one thing a person really needs to be aware of. But what exactly is considered a crisis?
So according to, good question, Ron, according to WebMD, red blood cells are usually round and have some give to them. Their shape lets them move easily throughout your body. But when you have sickle cell disease, some cells are curved, like a sickle shape, and hard. They don't flow as easily and they can get stuck in the small blood vessels in your veins, of your chest, belly, joints, and other areas. That's when you have a sickle cell crisis.
So then I assume you have had at least one of these crises leading to bone death. Can you tell our listeners
yes.
what it was like? And is it something that sends you to the hospital for treatment right away?
So I always describe a sickle cell crisis like being stabbed repeatedly. It's a very deep, intense pain that is really quite remarkable. You can't focus on anything else when you're having a crisis because the pain literally disables you physically. It's like having a seizure. I have had multiple crises over my lifetime. Most were quite severe, requiring strong hospital analgesics such as oxycodone and morphine. So I spent a lot of my childhood, I think I was 3 years old when I had my first morphine drip.
Oh my gosh.
Was quite debilitating as a child and left me unable to walk most days because the crises were almost always in my legs. I missed out on quite a lot of school, so I did most of my education at home in bed. So I definitely had an interesting childhood. And when I was in hospital, I remember vividly hallucinating because the medication was opioid-based. So I'd be looking at all sorts of patterns and colours on the walls in front of me, which was a nice distraction from the pain. But obviously being on any kind of strong painkiller at that such a young age is a lot to experience. And obviously these days I don't have as many severe crises. I was diagnosed with avascular necrosis, which resulted from a bad crisis, and obviously I was given the option to have treatment.
Okay, and speaking of treatments, I've heard that blood transfusions are sometimes a course of action for patients with sickle cell. Is that something that you're able to utilize as a treatment method?
Yes, so growing up I used to have blood transfusions in England. Here in Australia I'm able to have what's called a blood exchange, which is slightly more complicated procedure but more effective for long-term health.
Okay.
And I have this done every 4 weeks.
And then is it a concern now with the coronavirus and everything? Is that putting extra pressure on you to go in for these treatments, or is it something that can be done at home?
Yeah, so the coronavirus has definitely put a real dampener on everything. So because I'm also a health worker, I work in pharmacy, and I fall into the immune compromised category, it is a little bit hard to juggle. My treatment has remained the same, but it obviously means with the extra precautions we're taking now, I have to go to hospital alone. So my partner, who has supported me for the past 6 years, he can't come with me anymore. So I have to walk through the hospital wearing a mask. I have to sanitize every checkout point. And obviously the hospital is quite a ghost town at the moment. A lot of patients that have stem cell transplants don't want to have them done anymore for obvious reasons. So most of the time I'm alone with a nurse, one or two nurses, and there's a lot of sanitization involved. So it's quite a lonely process. But it's something that needs to get done. So at this point, I'm still having blood exchanges every 4 weeks, and I'm just taking extra precautions when I know that my hemoglobin levels are getting low.
Okay.
And so during these transfusions, all of the misshapen or sickle-shaped cells are being removed from your system. Is that correct?
Yes. So what I have is called a red blood cell exchange apheresis. Their blood is removed through a needle or catheter. It's circulated through a machine where the blood is separated into red cells, white cells, platelets, and plasma.
Mm-hmm.
The red cells, which are responsible for carrying oxygen to all parts of the body, are discarded and replaced with red blood cells provided by a blood donor. The donor red blood cells are then recirculated back to the patient with the other blood components, such as their white cells, platelets, and plasma, through a return needle. Whereas a blood transfusion, you're having the red blood cells from the donor, but you're not having your sickled cells removed from the body.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how can a person prevent a crisis? Because it sounds like that's something that you definitely want to prevent.
Absolutely. Now, there's no sure way that you can really prevent a crisis, but you can lower your odds by avoiding certain things. So swimming in cold water and reducing your chances of being in very cold weather or very hot weather, extreme temperature changes can trigger it. Maintaining a healthy diet and limiting your sugar intake so that your blood is thinner and flowing easier through your veins. Dressing in warm clothes when it's cold outside or when you're in air-conditioned or drafty buildings. Ensuring that you're drinking plenty of water. And obviously flying on commercial airlines is really important because planes that don't control air pressure could cause problems, especially when you're at very high altitudes. Obviously, limiting how much alcohol you drink is also important, and managing your stress is a big one. Stress can bring on a crisis. Even excitement can bring on a crisis, which is bizarre, and I think it's because, obviously, your cortisol levels are higher and there's a lot of adrenaline pumping through your body, so you want to maintain a sense of calm as much as you can.
So a little bit of meditation going on all the time for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you know that they have discovered that one of the problems with COVID-19 is that in some patients, not all, some patients have a fever, some patients have a cough, some patients have trouble breathing. Some patients have multiple blood clots and they don't know why. And the blood clots are causing strokes. So you might want to ask your doctor about that. Because there aren't any other symptoms other than a sudden stroke. And I'm thinking that, you know, you guys are probably in a much higher risk because of the sickle cell. You know, you could certainly get a blood clot just from that. So just talk to your doctor about that. I've been doing a lot of research on COVID, and that surprised me.
And I think we're going to talk to someone
about... Thank you, Leda. I didn't know that.
Okay, go ahead, Ron.
Hi, Sophia. I wanted to ask you, does the sickle cell disease adversely affect your life in any other ways than what you've already described?
Yes, that's a good question, Ron. There are definitely days when my mental health suffers. As a 26-year-old woman, despite having a good job and working towards my ambitions, I definitely feel that sickle cell has pushed me a little further behind in the race towards success. It's affected my self-esteem, it's affected my libido because I'm combating fatigue, and because of my hip, I do have a limp. So there are definitely times when I had to come to terms with the fact that I wasn't as young and agile as other women my age, and that a simple walk down the beach would obviously affect me for the rest of the day. I had to remind myself that I was attractive even when my body wouldn't cooperate. So modelling helped me immensely with shedding the fear of owning my story. That's why it was always so important for me to be such a strong advocate for other women with invisible illness, and create a platform where we could talk about that and still remember that we are beautiful even with that condition, because it's definitely something that can affect your self-esteem over a long period of time.
For sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
And not only is she pretty, Ron, she's model pretty.
So when you go to Australia, you know where to visit.
Yeah.
She's got a partner. Sorry, Ron.
Sorry, Ron. But no, but too late. If you want to learn more about sickle cell, you know.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, Sophia, tell us more about the advocacy that you actually started an advocacy program, right?
So my time with Sickle Cell Advocacy in South Australia is in its baby steps. I'm fortunate to be a part of such a passionate team of advocates. And I was actually, I reached out to Aggie in interstate, and we started discussing the potential of starting an advocacy program here in South Australia. So I'm part of a team of about six people. We have a chairman, and we have a secretary, and people that oversee what we do. So I'm very grateful to be a part of a sickle cell advocacy because it's not something that has ever existed here in Adelaide, and with all the blood disorders that we have here, it's really important to stand up and have a voice for people that may feel that they don't. And I'm hoping once social distancing protocols have ended and we all return to a sense of normality, that we can definitely run more events and spread awareness about sickle cell. The advocacy's main aim is to empower others to use their voice and share their story. So I'm really grateful to be a part of that.
Oh, that's great. And you have a YouTube channel too, right?
Yes, I do. So my YouTube channel, The Sick Sexy, was born from the passion and desire to reduce the stigma with disability and invisible illness, and remind each other that living with an invisible illness doesn't just mean that we're patients. I think it can be so easy to get lost in the technical diagnosis of your condition and lose your identity. So despite living with chronic pain or illness, you know, I want to spread the message that you're more than a patient. You can be attractive and beautiful and love your body and have the courage to share your truth proudly, which is something that I think we all struggle with when we have an illness. And as I said, it's something that can really affect your identity. So my YouTube channel really just helps inspire people to realise that their invisible illness doesn't have to be a negative diagnosis. It can actually be part of something so much bigger. And through reducing that stigma, hopefully we will start to see disability in a whole different light.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, that's a great way of looking at this.
Yes.
Thank you for that.
We'll make sure that we include your YouTube channel on our website as well.
Yeah.
Sophia, do you have any tips, hints, or suggestions for our listeners that have sickle cell, or their child has sickle cell, or a family member? How have you gotten through it, and how can you help others get through it?
Absolutely, that's a great question. I think it's really important to be an advocate for yourself. I hear too much that people are apologetic for asking questions to their doctors. They're afraid to ask the wrong questions to their hematologist, and so a lot of questions go unanswered. Maybe treatment gets delayed for many years, and the only way that you can ever live with this disease and look after yourself is to ask the right questions. So I'd always recommend that if you've just been diagnosed with sickle cell disease, or if you're concerned that your child may have sickle cell disease and you don't know, to always speak with a hematologist, have the right blood tests, and ask them what some of the symptoms are of sickle cell disease. When it comes to terms with looking after yourself, obviously take care of the physical part, as we mentioned, have blood transfusions or hydroxyurea or any other treatment that's available to you in your country, but also be aware that even though this is a physical condition, it can affect you mentally. So
sure,
it's very important to be aware of your emotional well-being and be aware of your emotional health. That's key. So, and also don't isolate yourself. This condition can be very isolating because it's invisible. So a lot of people will look at you and not necessarily understand if you're in a lot of pain because it's not visible to the naked eye. So just ensure that you have a voice and that you're advocating for yourself.
Very, very nicely said. Thank you.
Very pointed.
That's absolutely great advice, Sophia. And we do appreciate you coming on our show and sharing your story with us today. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Sophia.
Thank you guys for having me.
You're welcome. Ron, I walked on you.
If our listeners have any questions or comments related to today's show, they can contact us at podcastdx@yahoo.com, through our website, podcastdx.com, on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, or Instagram.
And if you have a moment to spare, please give us a review wherever you get your podcast. As always, please keep in mind that this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment before undertaking a new healthcare regime. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this podcast.
Till next week.